Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Whether you head straight for the roller coasters or stick to the merry-go-round, amusement parks are a popular summertime destination. And aside from a little nausea and sunburn, they seem like pretty safe family-friendly places. But not necessarily, says a new study which found that during the summer, an average of 20 kids a day are sent to emergency rooms in the U.S. because they've been injured on park rides. Here to tell us more about this is Dr. Gary Smith, director of the Center for Injury Research and Policy at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome to the show, Dr. Smith.
Glad to be here.
I wanted to break it down for our listeners a little bit. This isn't 20 kids a day all year round. It's from May to September. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. We investigated injuries involving children younger than 18 years of age who were treated in hospital emergency departments across the country. And on average, there's about 4,400 children a year. And that comes out to about one every 2 hours on average across the country. During the warm weather months, not surprisingly, there is an increase in the number of injuries, and that's where the 20 children per day comes from.
So what kinds of injuries are we talking about? Is there a pattern that we can talk about?
Well, the good news is that many of these injuries are minor. And so I think that's one of the take-home messages. Even though I would say the injuries aren't rare, they're largely minor, and these children could be treated and sent home. Only less than 2% required admission to the hospital. But we saw bumps and bruises accounting for about over a quarter, and injuries that involve broken bones, less, like 10%. So the good news is most of these are minor, and therefore I think we don't want to be alarmist about this. Mm-hmm. We simply want to make sure that parents understand the issues involved, and it depends on age group because we see different injury patterns for the young kids versus the older.
You know, you always see when you go to the big parks, you always see somebody trying to sneak in a little kid that doesn't belong. They're always trying to talk their way onto the ride. The kid's not tall enough, or that sort of thing. What about that? What are those? You know, they say if you're this tall, you can. Unless you're this tall, you can't ride on the ride. Why are they doing that?
Well, it's a real important take-home message for this study, and that is those warnings, those requirements are important, and parents should heed those. Children should heed those because a lot of the times those height requirements are going to determine whether the restraint systems that are in the ride will adequately restrain the child when the ride is in motion. And one of the things that we don't want is for a child to come loose during a ride and then be thrown free, and that's where a very serious injury could occur. But maybe even more important is that those types of restrictions, whether it's height or age, they may not really adequately capture the developmental stage of that child. And there are some children that simply, even though they meet those minimum requirements of height and age, may simply not be ready. And parents need to be able to make that judgment because if a child becomes frightened and tries to climb out of the ride while it's in motion, we've seen injuries from that as well. So these are guidelines. They're minimum. So parents should really use judgment in addition to those.
Did you determine or did you see any patterns in what rides were more dangerous than others?
Well, the quick answer is no, in that there's a huge limitation in this study, and that is we don't have numbers about ridership. So we don't know how many people are riding on roller coasters versus, for example, coin-operated amusement rides in your local mall or arcade.
Okay.
But one of the things that we think that this study does for the first time is give a picture of the entire spectrum of amusement ride-related injuries to children, because we didn't focus just on roller coasters and large rides, which has typically been the focus in the past. We looked at not only those rides in the large theme parks or amusement parks, but looked at also traveling mobile rides like you might have in a traveling carnival or fair. We also looked at those that are found in your local shopping mall, restaurant, or arcade. And what we found was really interesting, and that is for the local arcades and restaurants and shopping malls, there's a large number of kids, primarily under 5 years of age, who are being injured. Most of those are due to falls, about three-quarters, and those we know can be prevented because we know that in a fall, the most important thing is how much energy is transferred to the body, which is determined by the height of the fall and how cushioning the surface is. So we can fix those things. We can make sure those rides have restraints, and we can inform parents how important it is to use the restraints on those rides that they're provided.
If the injuries are so common, do you wonder why there isn't more regulation, or do you think there is enough regulation?
Well, I think there is regulation out there, and clearly there are many safety standards. There's an umbrella group called ASTM that has many, many standards that apply to rides. And the issue is more about uniformity of enforcement and also reporting of injuries when they do occur. Right now in this country, we have a patchwork of regulation. The federal government, through the Consumer Product Safety Commission, oversees the safety of mobile rides, so the traveling carnivals and fairs. But local governments and state governments have jurisdiction over fixed rides, like in theme parks or amusement parks, and also in your local neighborhood arcade or shopping mall. So given that, there's a lack of uniformity, and we know that has led to a lack of coordination in collecting information, so we even know how many injuries are occurring.
Mm-hmm.
This study was very hard to do because of that. And in addition, we know that there are opportunities for better enforcement.
What about concussions? Because that's something that you can't ordinarily see. Maybe some kid quickly gets his head clunked in the tilt-a-whirl or whatever it might be. Parent might not even notice it.
It's a good point, Anne. And one of the things that we were very careful about is, even though a child may be sent home after being seen in the emergency department, we know that, especially with head injuries, symptoms can continue to occur if there's a concussion for some time afterwards, and that's why follow-up with their primary care doctor is going to be important. We know that concussion and what we call closed head injury occurred in about 7% of the children in this study, and I think that's significant.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these were among younger children. These are children who fell often to a hard surface, and children under 5, because they don't have the coordination and the strength in their arms, they also have a high center of gravity. It's up near their chest. They tend to topple forward head first. They often strike their head when they fall. And we know in that group in particular, we see a higher proportion of concussions and these closed head injuries. So that's why it's so important to have restraints on those types of rides, which are typically the coin-operated rides in your arcades, and to make sure they're over cushioning surfaces so that these injuries do not occur.
I was kind of intrigued by the idea of the rides at malls and shopping centers. I mean, are you talking about the ones where they have a little pony in the front of the grocery store, and you put the quarter in and it goes back and forth?
That's absolutely right. And there's others that obviously move along a track at a slow speed. These are all primarily aimed at children younger than 5 years of age. You might go to a local restaurant for a birthday party.
Mm-hmm.
Those rides often do not have restraints, often are over hard surfaces. And one of the things that this study did for the first time is give parents a glimpse at this whole spectrum of amusement ride-related injuries. And I think there are some take-home messages about preventing those that are occurring right here near your home. And so I think we're really trying to give information to decision makers. One, the parent, also the manufacturer and the operators, but also the policymakers, the government that oversee enforcement. So I think this paper has a lot of messages for a lot of people. But for local businesses and for parents taking children to our local arcades, one of the things we can really focus on are preventing those falls from occurring, which will help us with the concussions and closed-head injuries.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Dr. Gary Smith, director of the Center for Injury Research and Policy at Nationwide Children's Hospital, we have a few minutes. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I know we're talking about kids right now, but there are also cautions about pregnant females and that sort of thing. Any thoughts about that?
Well, we didn't at all look at individuals 18 years of age and older.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have any data on that. But pregnancy and other health conditions also can determine risk when we're talking about rides. Often these have to do with more of the fast, larger rides, because they have a certain amount of deceleration or acceleration involved,
mm-hmm.
and that could do potential harm. But that wasn't the focus of this study, because we really wanted to give a much broader view of the problem. We really felt like the roller coasters and the large rides had just simply gotten a disproportionate amount of attention. Not that there aren't issues there that can be addressed, But we really felt the medical and public health community needed to also look at other situations that children are involved in on rides, looking at ways that we can prevent injuries across that entire spectrum and across the entire age group.
And I wanted to get back to a topic you brought up, the maturity of the child. Even if they're old enough, even if they're tall enough or they weigh enough, they may not be mature enough. And when you were talking about they might try to crawl out, that could be something as slow as one of those little teacup rides that go around. If it's moving and they're crawling out of it, they can really hurt themselves.
They can. And we know of very serious injuries. And I even know of a death that occurred to a young child who got frightened when the ride stopped unexpectedly at sort of the height of the ride.
Oh, yeah.
And the restraints for that age group weren't enough to keep them in, and they climbed over the side and fell and had a fatal injury. Those kinds of injuries are rare, thankfully. And one of the things I don't want to do is be sort of an alarmist about rides, because I think that rides are, you know, a fun pastime for kids and can be done safely. But I think the message from here in this study is that there are opportunities for even improving the safety beyond where it is now. So rather than be an alarmist, we want to provide information so people can make balanced judgments, informed decisions, and look for ways that they can improve safety even more than it is now.
What about riding with your child? When do you think a child is old enough to ride by themselves?
That's a good question. And there I think we need to follow posted signs and so forth. Often it's not only because the parent can help make sure the child doesn't try to wiggle out of a restraint, but there are other times where, depending on where the parent or the larger person is sitting, if there's a lot of acceleration or deceleration, their weight may even be thrown onto the child. So there are loading instructions about where the heavier person should sit in some cases. And clearly, if a restraint fits over both of you, I can still remember riding with my father when I was a young boy, and that bar came down over his lap, but it was about 6 inches before it came over mine, and I felt like I was going to fly out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those are the kinds of things we have to be really careful about. That's why operators are so important, because they can oversee the safety of those rides, make sure that children are the appropriate weight, size in terms of height and age to ride. But then there's this other element of, are they developmentally ready? Are they going to be able to handle the anxiety? Are they going to try to escape? And those are things only parents probably can answer. And that's why decision-making by the parent and the guardian are going to be so important.
Okay. Well, Dr. Gary Smith, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
I'm very happy to be here and hope to join you some other time talking about child injury.
Me too. Dr. Gary Smith, director of the Center for Injury Research and Policy at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Coming up, more from Wellness Wednesday. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
For a real-life murder mystery, watch WOSU-TV Wednesday night. 57 men came to America from Ireland looking for a better life. 8 weeks later, all the men were dead. It's a classic whodunit containing foul play and cover-ups. Watch Secrets of the Dead, Death on the Railroad, Wednesday night at 10 on WOSU-TV.
Checking the weather forecast for Central Ohio, scattered showers and possible thunderstorms today with a high of 72 expected. Tonight, scattered showers, a low of 53. On Thursday, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, otherwise partly sunny. Thursday's high, about 78 degrees. Right now, we have 63 degrees at our studios here on the OSU campus.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Young people, especially teenagers, have a reputation for thinking they're invincible. But a recent study at OSU found that young women fear the potentially deadly human papillomavirus, or HPV, not because it can cause cancer, but because of its symptoms. HPV is the most common sexually transmitted disease in the country. Here to discuss what the study means for the fight against HPV is Janice Krieger. She's assistant professor of communications at OSU. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in this study, you showed young women and older women a packet of HPV info materials, one that focused on cancer prevention and the other on genital wart prevention. What were their various reactions?
Well, the study was designed to test whether telling young women that HPV causes genital warts as compared to HPV causes cervical cancer would be more motivating and encouraging them to talk to their doctor about whether the vaccine was right for them. We also did the same thing for their mothers to determine whether parents would react differently to these types of messages than their daughters.
And what did you learn?
Well, we thought that young women, as you said, would be more frightened by the idea of genital wart as compared to cancer because protecting reproductive health is such an important concern to young women of this age. And what we found is we actually didn't find evidence that they were more afraid of genital warts, but our conclusion that we should use genital warts as a frame for cervical cancer HPV messages is based on the finding that young women found that they felt more able to talk to their healthcare provider when you said that the HPV vaccine prevents genital warts as compared to cancer. And so we think that's really important because our ultimate goal is to get young women, encourage young women to talk to their healthcare provider about the vaccine.
That's an interesting spin when I think about it. I thought it was going to be the other way around. They don't want to talk about cancer.
Well, we know that they feel more able to talk about genital warts. And, you know, we don't have definitive reasons for why that is. But if we think about, you know, the college experience or the experience of young adulthood, you know, STIs are something that this population talks about probably a lot more than cancer. And so it makes sense that they might feel more able to bring this topic up with a healthcare provider given that experience.
What about the parents? How did the mothers react?
You know, we had the opposite hypothesis for the mothers. We thought they would be more motivated to talk to their daughters if we framed the vaccine as preventing cancer. And interestingly, we found no differences. It didn't matter how we framed the message. That was not a motivating factor for them. However, one important finding with the mothers is that mothers who had higher self-efficacy, they felt like they could bring this topic up with their daughters, were more likely to follow through with a recommendation that their daughter talk to their healthcare provider about the vaccine. So we were excited about that.
So going forward, what does this mean about communicating about this STD?
I think that it's really important for, you know, both health centers as well as healthcare providers to think about, you know, when they're bringing up the vaccine, that for women in early adulthood, it makes more sense to emphasize the reproductive health issue of genital warts as opposed to trying to scare them against cervical cancer.
Okay. All right, Janice Krieger, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate it. Janice Krieger, an assistant professor of communications at OSU. Joining us now is Dr. Rebecca Perkins. She's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Boston University Medical Center. Welcome, Dr. Perkins.
Thank you.
So a number of years ago, the Centers for Disease Control recommended that all adolescent girls get the HPV vaccine to protect against cervical cancer, and there was a big increase in vaccinations initially, and then the rate started dropping off. Why doesn't everybody just get vaccinated? What's the issue?
Well, that's what I've been spending the past few years trying to figure out. I think part of it is actually any vaccine, when it's first introduced, takes a while to catch on. Less so with infant vaccines, but, you know, if you look at the history of the hepatitis B vaccination or the chickenpox vaccination, those uptakes were not really any faster than the HPV that we see today. It is going a little bit slower than the meningococcal vaccination, which was also recommended around the same time, and the uptake's been a little bit better for that one. But we do continue to see increases in the rates of HPV vaccination in girls. We'll have to see what happens with the boys because that's a new recommendation.
Right. And I remember a few years back seeing lots of commercials. I don't know whether they were public service announcements or whether they were from the pharmaceutical companies, but there were a lot more commercials about talking about it and talking to your daughter and all that kind of. I don't see them anymore. Maybe I've switched channels, but I'm just not seeing them.
There was a huge media blitz, and that was not public service. That was Merck, the pharmaceutical company, put out a very big ad campaign right in the beginning. There's a lower-level ad campaign going on right now that I've seen more in print, reminding parents that it's now recommended for boys and girls. I haven't seen it, though, you're right, to the same level as those old commercials.
And what's happening with the boys?
It's a little bit too early to say because their recommendation was just in the end of 2011, and then the American Academy of Pediatrics put it in their February guidelines in 2012. So we don't have any data to see what's happening with the boys, but among providers who I've talked to, they are actually usually surprised at how well it goes relative to the girls.
What do you mean?
They find that parents are more likely for their daughters to say, oh, she's not ready, we don't need to do this yet, can't we wait? And they're less likely to say that with their son.
Oh, same old problems. What change that now includes the boys?
New data. So there is the studies were first done in women for cervical dysplasia, and the results of those studies were available earlier. And so those results were available in 2006, and they considered the data and made the recommendation for women. Then for males, they looked at the endpoints of genital warts and anal dysplasia or anal cancer precursors, and the results of the genital wart studies were ready in 2009, and that's when it got the permissive recommendation for males, but not the strong recommendation because at that point there was no cancer endpoint for males. And then by 2011, they were able to show that it was able to prevent the precursors of anal cancer in males, and so then they were able to actually show a cancer endpoint and give it that stronger recommendation. Around that time, what was also coming out was data that the rates of oral cancers in men that are HPV related are rising dramatically. And it's actually estimated that the number of oropharyngeal cancers, head and neck cancers caused by HPV, will outpace the number of cervical cancers by the year 2020. And that also factored into their thinking of recommending this vaccine for men.
Why isn't this a vaccine that we can just give children, that it's just brought out with the usual array of vaccines when they're children?
You mean in the infant schedule?
Yeah, in the infant and the young, yeah, and as they get older.
I'm not sure there is a reason that it can't be. I know the studies to look at how effective it was were done in 16 to 25 year olds, and then they did studies to make sure there were good enough antibodies in the younger adolescent age group. I don't think it's been studied in the elementary school age group. There's no reason, if it provides lifelong protection, I think there's no reason not to give it to that age group, since the compliance would be better because they go to the doctor more often. I think that because of the controversy around the vaccine, it would be a little bit hard to suggest it at age 4 or 5 unless you could give a really good reason.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our Welcome Wednesday, our Wellness Wednesday segment. Joining me now is Dr. Rebecca Perkins. She's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Boston University Medical Center. We're talking about the HPV vaccine. It's the vaccine to protect against cervical cancer in women and other kinds of cancers in men. If you have a question or comment about it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Let's talk about the controversy about the vaccine. What is it, and what are the different points of view?
So There's anytime there's a new vaccine, people are always concerned about whether it's going to be safe in the long term. And I think with this vaccine, we can very, very confidently say that it is. More than 100 million doses have been given worldwide, and there are many studies on efficacy, on safety, not just from the United States, but from Australia, from Sweden, from the United Kingdom. And other than a less than 1% risk of fainting, there are no long-term side effects from this vaccine at all. So I think the safety concerns should be put to rest, although those are not always, sometimes it takes a long time and a lot of evidence to convince people of the safety of new vaccines.
Was there a problem with people, too, thinking, like you mentioned earlier, well, my daughter's not ready because she's not sexually active yet?
Right. And I think there is the connotation that this is, quote, the sexually active vaccine, which actually makes no sense if you think about the way all vaccines work. Vaccines are prevention. You need to be vaccinated before you are exposed to the disease or it doesn't work. And if the vaccines provide lifelong protection, as we believe that they do, you could vaccinate at birth, you could vaccinate at 5, you could vaccinate at 10. And if she has sex for the first time when she's 32, she should still be protected. So it doesn't make sense for parents to want to wait until they think their child may be having sex to give them this vaccine, because then it actually might not work. So that is out there, but it's really completely illogical.
Are prophylactics at all helpful?
You mean condoms?
Yes.
Condoms decrease but do not eliminate the risk of HPV because it's a skin virus and it can be on parts of the skin that are not covered by a condom.
Are there special considerations for the HPV vaccine that aren't there for, say, the mumps or rubella vaccines?
Can you be a little more specific?
I'm not really sure. I mean, does it affect when you get the vaccine? Does it have any side effects?
A sore arm, as all vaccines will give you a sore arm, and then there is a less than 1% risk of feeling woozy or fainting after the vaccine.
Okay. You participated in a study recently that found a major discrepancy in the rates of vaccination among racial groups and socioeconomic groups, and not necessarily how you'd think. What surprised you?
So just to be clear, that was from the CDC, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report.
Okay.
So while I would love to have taken credit for that, that was not my study. But it did show higher rates of vaccination among Black and Hispanic girls, as well as poor girls, compared to more affluent and white girls.
What does that tell you?
So that's very interesting, and it's not entirely clear what the reasons are behind that. Some of it may have to do with vaccine skepticism. We know that white and more educated parents are often more nervous and suspicious about all vaccines, not particularly the HPV vaccine, but all the childhood vaccines. You hear about alternative schedules and all this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Among some of the providers that I talk to, there definitely is there seems to be a little bit more, not any difference in the sexual behavior of adolescents from different racial or ethnic or poverty groups,
mm-hmm.
but there seems to be a little bit less awareness by their parents among the white and higher socioeconomic status groups, in that they think their children aren't doing things that their children actually are doing. And insurance may play into this a little bit, mm-hmm. because even though teens can receive confidential care from their providers, if their provider does any sort of testing on them, so if a teen is sexually active and is supposed to get a chlamydia test, their parent is going to get the bill if they have private insurance. And I think that actually can really impede the ability to give good care to privately insured adolescents around sexually transmitted infections.
Are there other alternatives for adolescents, sexually active adolescents, to get the kind of care they need without notifying their parents? I mean, is that an option?
That's going to vary a lot, mm-hmm. by where they live and how many facilities there are and that kind of thing.
Okay. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. JR in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, JR.
Yes, I'm actually concerned with the accuracy of the adverse effects that are reported from HPV vaccinations. Your viewers can go to the CDC website and actually search for reported adverse reactions, which include hundreds of fatalities associated with HPV and serious consequences, including lifelong paralysis.
That's actually false. I don't know exactly where you got that information, but in the studies, anytime there's any concern about an adverse event occurring within the time window related to a vaccine, that can be reported. And then there is an extensive study to see whether or not anything makes sense to have been caused by the vaccine. So, for instance, if someone got an HPV vaccine and then walked out of the clinic and was hit by a car and died, that's very unlikely to be related to vaccination. And in any fatalities that they have been within a time window of vaccination that they've looked at, they've all been deemed to be completely unrelated. There are also not any higher rates of any sort of paralysis from the HPV vaccine, so that is actually false.
Okay. The study, the CDC study, asked parents of unvaccinated kids why they hadn't vaccinated them. What were the most common answers?
The most common answers were that they were concerned about side effects. Mm-hmm. As you can see, there's a lot of misinformation out there, like from our caller. Mm-hmm. If you go on YouTube, there are all kinds of horror stories, but unfortunately, they're not backed up by scientific data. But it's very easy to get your hands on lots of scary things that are not true. So safety concerns were up there, as well as feeling that it wasn't necessary because parents wanted to hold off until they felt their daughter was sexually active, which, again, doesn't make sense based on the way the vaccine works.
What do you recommend people do who are searching for answers? Where should they go? Their pediatrician, their gynecologist, who should they talk to? What do you recommend they look at?
Certainly, I would recommend talking to the person's own doctor, either a pediatrician or a gynecologist, because they should have pretty accurate sources of information, and also it will be someone that the person trusts. They've chosen to go to that doctor, and it's someone they have a relationship with and they can really ask their questions to. Also, the CDC website will have updated and accurate information.
All right. Well, Dr. Rebecca Perkins, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dr. Rebecca Perkins is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Boston University Medical Center. Coming up, more for Wellness Wednesday. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how Wall Street defanged Dodd-Frank. Gary Rivlin tells us how this Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which was signed into law 3 years ago, has subsequently been attacked and weakened by financial industry lobbyists and lawyers. It's the subject of Rivlin's article in The Nation. Join us.
Terry Gross and Fresh Air coming up in just 20 minutes here at 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
They say you are what you eat, so how much media do you consume every day? Are you gorging yourself on everything in sight, snacking between meals, sneaking the occasional tweet? I'm Audie Cornish. Look, if you've tried all the other news outlets but just aren't seeing results, check out the All Things Considered diet. Weekdays. More news, less filler.
Weekday afternoons at 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Quick check of the weather. Scattered showers possible today, maybe even a thunderstorm. 72 degrees for a high. Tonight, an overnight low of 53 with scattered showers. On Thursday, a slight chance of showers. Otherwise, partly sunny at a high of 78 degrees.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. working in the garden can be a great stress reliever. I spent the whole weekend doing that. And it can also be a dermatological minefield. There are thorns, thistles, poison ivy, and of course, stinging nettles. But nettles aren't just there to hurt you. They've been long used for medicinal purposes and even as a tasty side dish. Here to talk up this humble weed is Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Swartzberg.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So my only experience with nettles was walking through a field kind of in a park at night and not seeing what it was. But all of us started jumping around. We thought they were bugs or something.
Right. That's been my experience, too. They really can be a pain. They have in their stems a chemical called formic acid, and they also have histamine, and they have other chemicals that cause a poison ivy-like reaction, and they really hurt.
Yeah, they do. But what, you know, there's always a reason for these plants to have these, whether it's nettles or whatever, thistles and so forth, to have things that hurt you when you try to touch them. What are they protecting?
Well, they're protecting themselves. Mm-hmm. They keep animals from munching on them.
Mm-hmm.
So they really protect themselves with these chemicals. That's the trade-off that they have, yeah.
What do they look like?
Well, they're actually quite pretty. They have these serrated-like leaves that are real fine, mint-like perhaps in appearance. They're quite attractive when they're growing wild.
So what are they good for?
I think they're good for eating. they really taste good. I'd only had them a couple of times before we wrote this article, but since then I've eaten them several times. We made them at home as a pesto sauce. We substituted basil. I actually liked it when we combined it with basil. You can make a fresh tea from it that tastes pretty good. I didn't like it that much, but it tasted pretty good. But what I really like is just cooking them like you would cook greens, just stir fry them.
They do look like mint. Does the flavor resemble mint in any way?
It's got a little bit of a mini taste, but I thought it tasted more like spinach or cucumber with a touch of mint in it.
And as long as you're cooking it, you're going to cook out the sting, I guess.
Yeah, that's the good thing. just cooking it for a few minutes gets rid of all of those chemicals that cause that that reaction that we just want to avoid.
So they're good to eat, but are they good for you in any way?
I think so. It's interesting. They have, for a plant, they have an unusual amount of calcium in them, just about as much, if not more, than a cup of milk. They have vitamin C, vitamin K, potassium, some iron, fiber, carotenoids. Yeah, I think they're a pretty healthy plant.
And the stinging part of the nettle, you shouldn't eat it raw, though. You should cook it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, stay away from it raw. Frankly, I've not picked it myself. If you're going to pick it, make sure you've got good gloves on, because otherwise you'll get that chemical on your body. I bought it in farmers markets where somebody else has picked them and have them put in plastic bags and just drop the plastic bags in water and rinse them and then drop that in a pot to cook them.
I'm trying to think if I've ever seen them in a farmer's market. I'll look for them this weekend.
Yeah, they should be there right about now, because the best plants are the ones that you can pick in the early spring.
Are there, like, nettle supplements, vitamins?
There are.
Okay.
Yeah, there's supplements for everything, it seems. Jeez. Like. And that's where things get really a little bit crazy. If you go on the web, you can find them supplements with nettle supplements advertised for helping your adrenal glands, for making your skin look young, for helping your blood vessels, grow hair on your head, anti-inflammatory, all sorts of amazing claims. So it prompted us to go and look at the scientific literature to back up these claims, and it probably won't surprise you to know that there was really almost no science at all, and the little science there was were really poorly done studies.
So if you do take them as a supplement, it's good if you want to boost your calcium, but
No, not even that.
Not even that.
There's not even good evidence that it has a substantial amount of calcium in the supplements. No, if you want to get the nutrition from it, eat the plant cooked, as you point out. Otherwise, I would stay away from those supplements. There's very little science to back the claims. There's essentially no science to back any safety. There's some evidence to suggest it might increase your blood sugar or decrease your ability of your body to clot blood. So I would stay away from those supplements.
Okay. You've also reviewed research for your latest wellness letter on omega-3 fatty acids. Before we get into that, is what are they and where do we get them in our diet?
Omega-3 fatty acids are probably amongst the most studied of all the nutrients for cardiovascular health. About 10% of Americans take supplements with omega-3s. They're the third most widely used supplement in the United States next to multivitamins and calcium. So they're very, very popular. What they are is they're fats. They're polyunsaturated fats that have been shown in many observational studies to be healthful, particularly for the cardiovascular system. So there's been a lot of enthusiasm about these fats. There are two in particular that seem to have that effect. The really interesting thing about these omega-3s is that they're found in fish. And the observational studies have looked at people who have eaten fish or eat a lot of fish, particularly the fatty fish where we find the omega-3s, and groups of people that eat a lot of this fish have lower incidence of cardiovascular problems like heart attacks. And that's led to a lot of what we call qualified health claims that even the FDA has allowed, saying that they may reduce the risk of heart disease. So lots of enthusiasm about it for many years now.
And fatty fish, we're talking about salmon, sardines, herring.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Swordfish, although ecologically perhaps not a good idea.
Right.
Tuna, not the canned tuna, but tuna often has a lot of omega-3s in it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, as I said, omega-3s are really popular, but that wasn't what prompted us to write this article.
Okay.
What prompted us to write it was our review of the literature, and 2012 was not a good year for omega-3s. There were several really well-done, large studies that looked at the literature or that did primary research, and this time it wasn't observational. These were double-blinded studies. Placebo-controlled, so our gold standard. And they didn't show that omega-3s really did what the observational studies claimed they did. That is, they really didn't show that there was a lot of cardiovascular protection, or any, frankly. So it really raises a question as to whether taking these supplements, these were all studies about supplements, not about eating fatty fish. And there's a real question now as to whether these supplements are worth your while in terms of preventing a heart attack.
It was interesting in the newer studies that I read about in the newsletter, more of the participants were being treated with other medications as well, though, statins and blood pressure drugs and so forth, that could affect the impact the effectiveness of the omega-3s.
Right. Well, it wasn't so much that they would affect the effectiveness.
Okay.
But let me just put a little background to this. Everybody knows about, or most people know about, taking low-dose aspirin to prevent a heart attack, particularly if you've had a heart attack in the past.
Mm-hmm.
More recent studies have shown that aspirin doesn't appear to be as effective as the earlier studies. And we think the reason for that is that we've done a lot of things now in addition to prevent heart attacks, and so it's more difficult for something like aspirin to show its effect. For example, people are now taking statins. And those are really powerful drugs to reduce the chances of a heart attack for people who need them. And it's harder than for if you take aspirin plus a statin to show the effect of aspirin today. And we think the same thing may be going on with these omega-3s. That is, with all these other interventions for cardiovascular disease to prevent it, it's more difficult for omega-3s to show their worth.
So what do you make of that then? I mean, how do you proceed from there?
I think there are some clear ways to proceed. The studies with fish, the earlier studies with fish, really are compelling, even though they were observational. And I think people should proceed from the idea, and this the American Heart Association recommends this, and that is eat 2 or 3 servings of fatty fish a week. Vary the fish so you don't have to worry so much about getting one type of fish with perhaps more mercury in it, but eat at least 2 or 3 servings a week of fatty fish. I think that's a very good idea. If you have cardiovascular disease, that you're in another ballpark there, and that's where you need to talk to your doctor about perhaps the value of omega-3 supplements in addition to the fatty fish. And if you have very high triglycerides, omega-3s have been shown to lower those, so talk to your doctor about that. But for the average person, I think the message is get your omega-3s through fatty fish. There's good evidence there.
Okay. We want to turn back to nettles here with Mike from Westerville. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Your conversation about nettles caught my interest.
Mm-hmm.
A few years back, I've never tried any preparation that involved ingesting nettles or nettle products, but I did hear about something called a nettle patch. In fact, there was an article in the Dispatch about it, and there's an entrepreneur down in Bremen who got caught out in a patch of nettles, and he got stung a lot, and he had real bad arthritis, and when he came back in, the pain was gone. So he started a little factory where they made patches out of this stuff, and I was a total skeptic, but I thought, well, it can't hurt me. So I had arthritis in my hands and my thumbs, like I couldn't open jars and stuff. And I tried these patches, and for me, all I can say is it worked, and I put it on at night, and within about an hour of putting it on, the pain was pretty much gone, and I just took it off during the day because it turns your skin green, too.
Dr. Swartzberg, do you know about this?
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm delighted your arthritis is better. Mm-hmm. One of the claims that has been made for years and years about nettles is that it is immune modulating. We couldn't find research that substantiated that, but frankly, it's just because the research hadn't been done. And if it's immune modulating, that's what causes arthritis, abnormal immune response, at least for much of arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it could help in that way. I'd love to see these kinds of things studied in a more rigorous fashion.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Well, Mike, thanks for the call.
Sure thing. Thank
you. Take care. Bye-bye. Another nettle call, Dr. Swartzberg. Brian in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome, Brian.
Well, thanks a lot, Annie. Thanks, Dr. Swartzberg. I have tried the nettles and had a guest on a couple of years ago that had written a book about different types of things you could find around in your woods and harvest and use. And turns out they are really, really good. So I'm really amazed that they are so good for you. That's really great. The thing I was curious about is, have you looked at another herb that's around that grows here in Ohio very easily? It's got purslane, P-U-R-S-L-A-N-E. It's my family really likes that, and it's supposedly really good for you. So this has more. I'm just looking at Wikipedia, and it says it has more omega-3 fatty acids than alpha-linolenic and blah, blah, blah than about anything. So have you looked at that one?
No, we haven't, but we certainly will. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm a little skeptical about the omega-3 fatty acids. Most plants tend not to have that.
Yeah.
So, yes, we'll definitely look at it.
Brian, where do you get your nettles? Brian, where do you get your nettles from?
Oh, down along the Olentangy, down the bike path.
Yeah, that's where I got them when I was walking through the bike path. Okay.
Yep. Okay. Same here, so I'm afraid that we're probably competing for them, man.
Okay.
So,
right.
But try this purslane grows like in the sidewalk cracks, and it's kind of amazing. And everyone in my family, we really stick it on sandwiches and things, and it makes a really good pesto.
So
I really recommend just combining purslane with pesto, grind it up, and with a little Parmesan, olive oil, and I think you'll be really impressed.
All right. Well, thank you, Brian.
The worst. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Interesting. Well, you also wanted to chat today about ultrasounds, and I'm glad you wanted to talk about this because I'm starting to see these ultrasound screening packages, as you refer to them, but they're just being offered up ad hoc without a doctor's prescription or anything.
Yeah, we just at our home, we probably get an advertisement for one of these ultrasound screening procedures coming to your town, special prices, discounts, yeah. and so on. And these come almost monthly now. They really look impressive. Good advertising, but bad idea. This is the idea that a little bit of knowledge, more about your body, mm-hmm. how can that be bad? They screen for carotid artery problems that could lead to strokes, abdominal aortic aneurysms that could burst and kill you, osteoporosis, ovarian cancer. All of these are really legitimate tests that doctors certainly order, but they're always reserved for people who are at high risk for these problems. When I finally had our group look into the research behind this, and we came up with a lot of caveats about doing these tests. A lot of false positives come from these tests, particularly when you're screening groups at low risk. And false positives create not only a lot of anxiety for people, but they lead to more testing, and sometimes the testing has to be invasive. So they can lead to a lot of problems, including over-treatment, which is going to cost a lot of money, and you might get treated for things you absolutely don't need. We also found that some people think, well, if the ultrasound turns out fine, which it does often, mm-hmm. Then they're fine, and they don't need to watch their saturated fats, and they don't need to exercise or watch their weight and so on. These tests are expensive. Insurance almost never pays for them, and usually these companies tell you, well, you should repeat them every year. And there's a real question about the quality.
I'm kind of surprised they're not regulated.
They're not regulated, and oftentimes the ultrasounds are not read by trained physicians. They're read by technicians. Oftentimes the ultrasounds are not done by licensed sonographers. We were really disappointed to discover this. And many times you'll get a report saying there's an abnormality, but no one takes the time to talk to you about them. So I would urge your listeners to stay away from these screening tests. Talk to your doctor about them and find out whether maybe you're at high risk for and need one of these screening tests, and he or she can order them for you. And then when the results come back, read by a trained physician, done by a certified technologist, your doctor can discuss the results with you and put the results into context so you understand them. But stay away from these wonderful deals that come across your home every few weeks.
All right. Well, Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks for joining us today to talk about all of that. I'm going to go out and dig around for some nettles now.
Great. I think I'm going to do that, too, but be sure to wear those gloves.
I will. Dr. John Swartzberg, he's chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. Hope you've enjoyed Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks goes out to our staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler and Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Ellen DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.